50 years ago, Lake Chad, a body of fresh water the size of the state of New Jersey, was the principal source of food and water for the people of Central Africa. The lake, which borders on Chad, Nigeria, Niger, and Cameroon, and contains hundreds of inhabited islands, now covers only 5% of the area it once did. And that contraction has led to devastating food shortages, dramatic increases in rates of poverty and disease in the region. And it's exacerbated political corruption and instability in the four countries it touches. It's also left the region vulnerable to attacks by Boko Haram, which has raided islands and kidnapped entire villages. Ben Taub called Lake Chad the site of the world's most complex humanitarian disaster in an article he wrote for the New Yorker's December 4th issue. He is a staff writer at the magazine, and I'm pleased that his article has brought Ben Taub back to our show. Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Lake Chad is located in Africa's Sahel, a semi-arid band of land that spans the width of the continent, separates the Sahara from in the north from the savannas of the south. Do you have any idea how many people currently live in the Sahel?
It's actually extremely difficult to estimate. The broad estimate is 100 million, but the problem is that the area is constantly shifting because it's a climate band, and because the desert is expanding, the band itself of territory of what counts as the Sahel is changing as well.
So it's expanded to more than those four countries I mentioned.
It stretches across the continent from Senegal all the way to East Africa.
And you say that the desert is growing. Is this attributable to climate change, or are there other factors?
There are certainly other factors. The Sahara long ago used to actually be the site of, you know, an incredibly lush environment. You have in northern Chad, in the Tibesti Mountains, an area that is now dead center of the Sahara. You have these ancient cave paintings showing elephants and rhinos and these animals that haven't been able to live there for thousands of years.
You focus most of your story on the people who live on the many islands scattered across Lake Chad. Approximately how many islands does the lake contain?
That too is hard to say because the water level changes so dramatically between the rainy and dry seasons that you at any given time you can't know how many islands there are because the mainland is constantly encroaching, and then it might rain for 3 days and then there will be more islands. It's so confusing.
So they connect to the mainland at times?
At times, yes. Many of the former islands have been completely swallowed up by the mainland and turned into permanent desert. But this is an enormous complication for the various militaries who are trying to fight in these islands because their vehicles are ill-equipped for this environment. They can get stranded in certain areas, and also because the territory spans these four different countries, they don't speak the local languages in many cases.
There are lots of different languages there.
Yes.
What, 150 or so?
In Chadian territory alone, there are about 150 different languages. And so you have most of the soldiers coming from the capital. They speak Chadian Arabic and a tiny bit of French. But at the lake, on the Chadian side, you have most people on the mainland speak Kanembu, and most people in the island speak Buduma. So they can't really communicate with each other, and neither of them can communicate with the
troops.
And
the languages are totally different?
Completely different, yeah.
Are most of the islands inhabited? Have they always been inhabited?
They have been inhabited for the past several hundred years. It's hard to get an exact read of when that began. There are sorts of like origin myths, essentially. But they were all emptied a couple of years ago in a forcible displacement by the Chadian army.
Didn't the French give Chad its name when they conquered the area in the early 1900s? What does the name Chad mean?
So Chad was named for a mistake. Essentially, when these European explorers showed up on the banks of this vast body of fresh water, they asked the locals, you know, where are we? And the people said Chad. But Chad just meant lake in the local dialect. And so now the French named it Lake Chad, and then they named the country next to it, which wasn't even a country. It was just sort of this vast swath of territory that's mostly desert, is now called lake.
The Europeans have done this all over. In the United States, there are places called Sagi Canyon, Canyon de Chelly, etc. The word Sagi is Navajo for canyon. So when they ask what is this place called, they said canyon.
Right.
And so you get canyon, 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 canyon.
And imagine if the United States was called canyon as a country.
Now, when the French arrived, were people living on the islands?
People were living in the islands, yeah. they were marginalized from basically that point on, and in fact beforehand, because there was a long history of the Buduma Islanders raiding Kanembu villages, and so there was always a tension between the people who lived in the islands and the people who lived on the mainland. The problem is, as the mainland grew, the resources for those living in the islands diminished, and so the complications got worse.
When did Chad gain its independence from France?
In 1958, it was part of French Equatorial Africa, and so that split up. And then Chad got independence, or announced its independence, on August 11th, 1960. But in that moment, it's really hard to say, you know, statehood is really a fundamental problem here, because Chad was a territory that essentially, you know, the French border, the Chadian border with Libya was delineated when the French ran into the Italians. The border with Sudan is where the French ran into the Brits. Same with the border with Nigeria. Its border with Niger and with Central African Republic were divided arbitrarily by the French. The French saw Chad as one of their least useful colonies because it really lacked the resources that they found elsewhere on the continent. And so as a result, they were sending their worst behaved and least experienced officers there, often as a kind of punishment, to try to sort of hold it together, but they never made any efforts at creating a state. And that created enormous problems when suddenly this territory was supposed to try to govern itself as if it was a unified territory.
Is it true that when it was a colony, some of Chad's residents didn't even know that they were a part of France, or even that they lived in a place called Chad?
Yeah, especially at the turn of independence. I spoke to, so some of the people in the islands, for example, told me that they found out that they belonged to what was now an independent country at the moment that formerly the white tax collector was replaced by a black tax collector.
I'm speaking to Ben Taub, who has written an article about the area around Lake Chad, which he calls the world's most complex humanitarian disaster. It's in the December 4th issue of The New Yorker. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You mentioned that Chad is among the world's poorest countries and point out that at the end of 1990, Chad had a population of roughly 5 million people, but only had 5 hospitals and a few dozen doctors.
Yeah.
So what happened when people got sick?
Well, the life expectancy of the average Chadian lived to 39 back in 1990. And it hasn't improved that much. I mean, right now the life expectancy is 51. So it's one of the least developed countries in the world. But the problem is it's one of the least developed countries in the world. But it's surrounded by the other least developed countries in the world. Niger, Central African Republic. These are not places that have ever come forward as states. And the borders
because it's artificial, as you point out. The borders really just are. Well, the British had a colony here, so that's one border. The French.
That was a lot of it. That was a lot of it, but you know, I went into this project never having questioned previously the validity of states as a functional model for the best kind of model for governance. But in studying Chadian history, it became clear that the state for most people who live in Chad has only ever existed as this sort of empowered body, rooted in the capital, run by whichever. And this is true of all of Chadian history, because every single change of power has been through violent military coup or something like that. So it's always been led by some, you know, warlord or former rebel who captured it from the last guy, and treats the population in an extraordinarily predatory manner, which most people have no benefit from being part of any state.
And as you have said, Lake Chad region is the least developed and least educated region on Earth. Have there been attempts to develop the area, or have foreign countries come in or NGOs and try to help?
One of the challenges there is that the lake itself traverses 4 borders. So it literally, the borders of Nigeria, Niger, Cameroon, and Chad cut through huts in the islands. They make absolutely no sense. And so you can't have a comprehensive approach unless all 4 countries are focusing on this together.
And they don't cooperate?
There are all kinds of historic tensions, particularly among the between the government of Nigeria, which is Anglophone, and the Francophone governments of the other 3 countries.
Well, Cameroon is kind of a mix.
Yeah, Cameroon has...
The French have kind of controlled it, but a major portion of it was Anglophone.
And is now. And in fact, that at the moment is a huge source of crisis in the country. There's a secessionist movement in the Anglophone part of Cameroon. And so you have, you know, each of these countries which is struggling to deal with its own economy, struggling to deal with its own unity, is now trying to also take on Boko Haram in a context where they're also fighting insurgencies or dealing with civil strife in other parts of their borders. So it can't really be anyone's top priority.
Now, how did Boko Haram come into this? It's a Nigerian-based organization. Mm-hmm. How far is Lake Chad from where Boko Haram began?
Boko Haram began in the Nigerian city of Maiduguri, which is in Borno State. Now, Borno State borders the lake. And Borno State actually used to be the site of, or the epicenter of the Borno Empire, which is what the French broke up when they divided it into these four countries. So that was one of the root problems here, is that one former African empire is now split in these four spots. So essentially, the founder of Boko Haram was a guy named Muhammad Yusuf, who used to wander the streets of Maiduguri, in the early 2000s, in a country that is Nigeria is the richest country in Africa, and yet its percentage, not just number, but the actual percentage of people living in total poverty is growing.
It also has a problem of having a north and a south, the north being basically Muslim, the south being basically Christian. Mm. It also had, at one point, a breakaway region that led to the Biafran War in the 1960s, I think it was. So it is not just a unified country.
No, all four of these countries have had numerous military coups. Well, I guess Cameroon, he's been in power for 35 years as a dictator. But in the other three, there have been numerous military coups, all kinds of political strife throughout history, rooting back to that moment that they were sort of, these colonial projects. But so what Yusuf did, and what was so successful, living in this in one of the poorest states of Nigeria, Borno, he was delivering these sermons about the ruinous legacy of colonialism and the corruption of Nigeria's elites, and he was saying, if we are to move forward in any cohesive way, we have to go back to what we were, which Borno used to be part of the caliphate. There was a Sokoto caliphate a couple hundred years ago. There's a tradition of jihadism unrelated to the caliphate. There's a tradition of jihadism that goes back hundreds of years in northern Nigeria. And so he was trying to revive that and saying, these colonial problems, these European problems, Boko Haram is a reference to sort of Western influence in education. This is the root cause of our problems, and we need to start from scratch.
He was arrested and executed by the Nigerian police, and his deputy took over, Abubakar Shekau. Was he as ruthless as Shekau?
Yusuf was not. Shekau was a complete madman. He, for example, they would go burning down villages, tossing grenades into huts and raping women and slaughtering men and kidnapping children.
To a point where ISIS has separated itself from them.
Yeah.
Even too radical for ISIS.
Shekau pledged his allegiance, and at first they accepted, but then they disowned him because his battlefield tactics were so depraved. He was sending, and is constantly to this day, often sending child suicide bombers to blow up themselves in markets and mosques.
And when did Boko Haram begin to invade the islands of Lake Chad?
It began in early 2015. But what was sort of happening under the radar before that was that because the islands were were completely neglected, they were never considered really to be part of Chad. And the people who lived them were always considered to be more under the influence of Nigeria. They even used Nigerian currency, even though they lived in Chad, most of them. So they'd been sending, there are no schools for the islanders, so they'd been sending their children to northern Nigeria for Quranic education. So a lot of those children in 2013-14 were essentially getting recruited into Boko Haram, calling their friends, saying, look, if you come and join us, we have access to food, we have education here, Islamic education, we have money, come be a part of this. And so people were very susceptible to this kind of recruitment as a matter of survival and resources. So when Boko Haram invaded the islands, there was certainly resistance. There were a lot of island chiefs who fought back. There were people who were killed in these attacks, but a lot of people did go willingly.
Because Boko Haram was promising access to basic services and Islamic education.
They were offering the state that, you know, the basic services that the state never had.
And
they didn't necessarily succeed in delivering those, but that was the promise, and that's why people joined.
And now those islands, those people are pushed into refugee camps?
Many, yeah. So when those attacks began, after the first couple of thousand people were displaced, who ran away from Boko Haram, who wanted nothing to do with it, the Chadian army went into the islands and issued an order. The Chadian army is known for its brutal battlefield tactics and disregarding human rights. And it went into the islands and told people, you have 1 week to evacuate. If you don't leave, we will consider you to be a combatant. And so people were terrified. They were afraid of an onslaught. And so they fled to the mainland, and they were not allowed into the local villages because of this historical tension between the Buduma Islanders and the Kanabu mainlanders. And so they were told, just wait in, you know, between the villages in these empty displacement sites where there's nothing, and the humanitarians will come and deal with it.
Have they been able to move back, any of them?
Some have begun to move back, but not, but really out of desperation. Essentially, the humanitarian community tried to fulfill Chad's unwanted obligations of statehood toward these people. They were trying to provide them with basics, food and services, but it wasn't enough. And so people started starving, so they started going back to the islands.
I'm speaking with Ben Taub, whose article on the situation at Lake Chad is in the December 4th issue of The New Yorker. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Ben Taub, who's a staff writer for The New Yorker. His article in the magazine looks at Lake Chad as the site of the world's most complex humanitarian disaster. How did you even learn about this story? How did you get interested in it?
It was actually, I'd been curious about Boko Haram for a while, but I had, as part of that, and including when I began this research, I was under the mistaken impression that the group is the root cause of most of the problems in the region, whereas in fact it became clear to me as I started actually, when I went there and I started speaking to people on the ground, that it's really a side effect of terrible history, terrible governance, population explosion, food insecurity. I mean, this is the Sahel is an area where the population has doubled in the past few decades and is going to double again in the coming years as the number of as the food vanishes due to environmental factors.
Because the lake is shrinking, and so all of the fish that people relied on are no longer available. You spoke at length with Musa Mainakane, a 68-year-old chief of the Bugumi, an island in Lake Chad's southern basin. He was born in the island, and he told you that when he was young, he and his family never went hungry.
Yeah.
He remembered cows and vegetation thriving on the island.
The lake really changed dramatically in the course of his lifetime. And it had fluctuations in the past. But when he was born, it was at its healthiest in many ways. And by the time he was in his teens, he started to notice that it was shrinking and shrinking. And the mainland was encroaching. And these masses of reeds and water lilies were blocking the waterways. So it was impossible to navigate these old trading routes between the islands. So that started hurting their economy. But then the rivers, you know, dried up during a drought. The Sahel region was stricken with famine, and all the fish started vanishing. And then it just got worse and worse. There was a plague of tsetse flies. The cows were getting sick. They were becoming infertile. The cows, they couldn't produce milk. There was no way of producing butter, which they used as a local medicine. And things just got worse and worse and worse until they were foraging in the bush for fruit and nuts, and then they ran out of those.
The tsetse flies infected the local cows with a disease. Do they know what the disease is?
No, they were unaware. Right now, I'm sure that after the Boko Haram displacement took place, humanitarian groups have been vaccinating the cattle. I'm sure the ICRC would know which diseases it was, but I don't. But an interesting component to this is that, you know, suddenly in 2015, because of Boko Haram, the humanitarian community stepped in and started focusing on this place because the funds existed for this sort of counterterrorism development project. But if Boko Haram were to disappear, I had the sense when I was there that if Boko Haram vanished, all those humanitarian funds would vanish too. The development money would disappear. And so in a kind of upsetting and horrible way, everyone is dependent on Boko Haram's existence as a distant and manageable threat.
So let's talk a little bit about Chad's political history. What kind of government was established there when it became independent in 1960?
It began with the first leader was a military dictator. He was in charge for about 15 years. He tried to start a sort of what became a failed project of statehood. He called this campaign Chattitude. But he was trying to impose taxes on a population that didn't understand them, and so he instigated a death penalty for tax evasion, and shortly afterward he was killed in a military coup. Then there was total chaos for several years, and until a rebel named Hissène Habré took over in a revolt in 1982. Basically, the CIA and Gaddafi had been sponsoring rebellions against each other for a very long time, backing different warlords, and the French would support whoever was in power at any given time until he was taken, his position was, he was unseated by the next guy, and then they'd support him. But this is what followed is you had, Hissène Habré was, he'd led three violent rebellions, he'd held Europeans hostages, as hostages, and yet in the moment he actually captured the capital, he was afforded all the international structures of legitimacy that any head of state has.
The CIA's been said to have backed a revolt in Chad in 1982 that made him, Habré, the president.
Mm-hmm.
And although he ran a vicious security state and tortured and executed tens of thousands of Chadian citizens, didn't the United States under Ronald Reagan supply him with hundreds of millions of dollars worth of weapons because
yes.
they saw him as a bulwark to Gaddafi, who was threatening to take over the area?
Gaddafi wanted to expand into the Sahel. And so to the CIA, to the United States, Habré was a palatable nightmare.
But then he was overthrown in 1990 by Idriss Déby,
who was backed by Gaddafi, and who is now still the president of Chad. Actually, as of a couple of days ago, he has just entered his 28th year as president of Chad.
He promised to establish democracy in Chad, but you've noted that although he did create a new constitution that promised freedom of religion, expression, demonstration, and freedom of the press, but people continue to disappear?
Yeah, anyone who tried to exercise their rights would vanish. He was never as vicious and brutal as Habré. He was a lot more savvy and aware of how to speak about democracy in the kinds of ways that made him palatable to the Western governments.
So the U.S. and France have continued to supply him with money and weapons?
Exactly.
And does any of that money trickle down to the people of Chad?
Very, very, very little. He mostly uses the money to restructure his security apparatus to protect his hold on power. He has put down scores of coups, and by that I mean literally multiples of 20, scores of coups and rebellions. Many of them are not bids to take over the country. Often, because there's so little effort to govern the country on the part of the state, rebellions are a way of getting attention and getting basic services drawn to your particular area of Chad.
How much time did you spend in the area?
I was there for 31 days in the summer, in July and August.
The United States continues to feel that Chad's must be kept, its military must be kept strong as a bulwark against what, Boko Haram?
Well, so now it's about terrorism, essentially. And we've tolerated kind of appalling things as a result of this sort of effort to back what we consider to be Sahelian governments, but are really acting as predators in the region. For example, 2008, Congress passed a law that banned any military support by the United States for any country that was using child soldiers. And Déby was recruiting tons of child soldiers to put off rebellions. It was widely, widely reported. But the United States got a waiver for Chad. Barack Obama requested a waiver for Chad because Chad was a country that was considered to be sort of an island of stability. They call it Chad and Niger, islands of stability in a region of chaos. And if you can support the autocrats there, strengthen their militaries, then they can be used to fight terrorism on a regional scale. The problem is that this fails to take into account the cruelties of colonialism and the predatory nature of the regimes that have developed in its place. So across the Sahel, you've got all these people who are not benefiting from statehood, living in the margins, and who are discovering that they live on border areas or cross constantly at the moment where the security forces encounter them for the first time and treat them as criminals. And so people, there's a lot of pastoralists in the Sahel, you know, migratory cowherdsmen, essentially, who depend on moving with the seasons. And for them, those borders are a threat to their livelihood. And you've seen that in the past few years, many of them have taken to the jihad.
You report seeing a number of the displacement sites when you travel through the Lake region in late July with two UNICEF employees. Didn't you notice that the sites that had been set up in Chad for refugees from Nigeria were much better equipped and more substantial than the ones that have been created for internally placed Chadians from the islands?
Yeah.
Why would that be?
Essentially, because the people who cross international borders get refugee status. People who are internally displaced have access to none of the funding and the rights that are afforded people who are classified as refugees. So it's much better to be a Nigerian refugee who crossed into Chad than it is to be a Chadian living on the other side of the lake. Essentially, you have, governments get to decide where humanitarian actors operate within their national territory. And so humanitarians are routinely compelled to enter in very fraught moral arrangements. You have, for example, in Syria, the UN is not allowed to deliver food or medicine to besieged civilians who oppose the regime. But the Chadian example on the lake is very common, where essentially you have a neglected patch of territory in which the international community is fulfilling the unwanted obligations of statehood.
But in a strange way, doesn't the Chadian government end up benefiting from Western aid that pours into the country because of Boko Haram's presence in the country?
Absolutely.
Is Boko Haram still a major presence in the Lake Chad area?
It is a major presence on the Nigerian side. It occupies a number of the Chadian islands, but there's sort of a frontline layer of islands, but it's not an existential threat to Chad in any respect. It's just simply this almost useful threat because its presence entails so much Western support, both military support to strengthen the regime and humanitarian support to take care of the people that the regime doesn't want to.
You've written that a multinational joint task force was established by the four countries that share the islands to fight Boko Haram. How effective has that force been?
It has been effective militarily in certain areas. It's taken back a lot of territory.
But
from
they
Boko
can't
Haram.
Cross each other's borders.
Right. So there are a lot of obstacles. A Western military advisor to the MNJTF told me that none of the countries want to shoulder the burden. So there are also linguistic issues. I was at the headquarters of the MNJTF many days, many hours. And, you know, the Nigerians don't really speak to the Chadians. They can't even speak the same language.
And isn't there also a weather problem? They can proceed during the dry season, but during the rainy season, there are real problems.
Yeah. When it's raining, they actually don't do any forward operations. So the rainy season is great for Boko Haram. Half the year, Boko Haram is losing territory, and half the year, it's gaining it back.
What do the island dwellers find when they return home? And how many have been able to return?
Roughly 40,000 have returned to the islands because they were starving on the mainland. A lot of people actually died of malnutrition while they were living in these supposedly safe displacement sites. So they've started to go back, but they're finding absolutely nothing. Their huts have been burned. All the cooking supplies have been stolen. Their cows are gone. The reeds have taken over more of the island, so they can't navigate by boat anymore to many places. And many of the trees have been burned down as well. And at first that was very confusing to me. But while I was traveling in the islands, as part of the UN security rules, because I was traveling with UNICEF, we had a Chadian soldier with us. And I asked him about this, and he said, well, yeah, we burned down all the trees because we didn't want them to come back home at night. We couldn't see them in the dark. So we lit all the trees on fire at night. And he had actually burned down the trees on one of the islands that he took us to.
Is Chad the worst of the situation of these four countries?
No. In some ways, it's the most stable, and therefore, I guess, I don't want to say the best, but
as terrible
Nigeria
as it
is the worst. Nigeria, the Nigerian side
Despite its wealth, its oil.
And yeah, the Nigerian side is the one that's really being destroyed by Boko Haram. Chadian side is more benefiting from Boko Haram.
You don't speculate in your article about what has caused Lake Chad to shrink so dramatically over the past 50 years. Can we attribute the shrinkage to some combination of climate change and the increased demands that have been placed on it by a growing population?
Absolutely. I didn't go into climate change too much, although it is ravaging the region, and the lake is included in that, because the lake has a bizarre and not fully understood history of shrinking and growing. For example, at the turn of the century in 1904, explorers found that it was quite large, and then 4 years later it had shrunk dramatically, but then it expanded again. But what we've seen in the past 50 years has been very clear. 95% shrinkage, it is a permanent issue.
In the past, Chad was threatened from the north by Libya, Muammar Gaddafi, and now from, it's not really the south, but from it's the southwest by Boko Haram from Nigeria.
Yeah, well, it's now actually, so this is very convenient for Idris Deby, the president. To the north, there is ISIS in southern Libya. To the west, there is Al-Qaeda in Niger. To the southwest, there is Boko Haram in Nigeria. And for this reason, he's getting an enormous amount of Western military support. But it's not at all clear that the United States has any strategy for this region, any long-term strategy. I spoke to numerous American diplomatic and military officials and asked them one simple question: can you please define a coherent long-term strategy for the region? And the vague wish that I kept hearing was that if we improve local governments and institutions and encourage democratic tendencies and facilitate development, terrorism will go away. But the flaw there is that in doing so, they're supporting the regimes that are at the root cause of much of the marginalization and strife that's driving people to the jihad.
Ben Taub's article about the disaster at Lake Chad is in the December 4th issue of The New Yorker. And Ben, as always, it's been a great pleasure having you on our show.
Thank you very much.
As terrible as the story you had to tell us was.
Yeah.